This is Randy Wasserstrom with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome you to our readings from Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl. With me today is Susie Pratt, who will be reading the actual diary entries written by Anne. This show is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Feel free to call us with any comments or questions about this show or any other subject pertaining to Triangle Radio Reading Service. We're here to serve our listeners, and your input will help us to do a better job. The number is 919-832-5138. Again, that's 919-832-5138. You can also visit our website at www.trianglereadingservice.org. Thanks again for joining us.
Wednesday, October 14th, 1942. Dear Kitty, I'm terribly busy. Yesterday, I began translating a chapter from Labelle Nivemaze and writing down vocabulary words. Then I worked on an awful math problem and translated 3 pages of French grammar besides. Today, French grammar and history. I simply refuse to do that wretched math every day. Daddy thinks it's awful, too. I'm almost better at it than he is, though in fact, neither of us is any good, so we always have to call on Margot's help. I'm also working away at my shorthand, which I enjoy. Of the three of us, I've made the most progress. I've read The Storm Family. It's quite good, but doesn't compare to Jupiter Hole. Anyway, the same words can be found in both books, which makes sense because they're written by the same author. Sissy Van Marksveld is a terrific writer. I'm definitely going to let my own children read her books, too. Moreover, I've read a lot of corner plays. I like the way he writes. For example, Hedwig, The Cousin from Bremen, The Governess, The Green Domino, etc. Mother, Margot, and I are once again the best of buddies. It's actually a lot nicer that way. Last night, Margot and I were lying side by side in my bed. It was incredibly cramped, but that's what made it fun. She asked if she could read my diary once in a while. Parts of it, I said, and asked about hers. She gave me permission to read her diary as well. The conversation turned to the future, and I asked what she wanted to be when she was older. But she wouldn't say, and was quite mysterious about it. I gathered it had something to do with teaching, of course. But I'm not absolutely sure, but I suspect it's something along those lines. I really shouldn't be so nosy. This morning I lay on Peter's bed after first having chased him off it. He was furious, but I didn't care. He might consider being a little more friendly to me from time to time. After all, I did give him an apple last night. I once asked Margot if she thought I was ugly. She said that I was cute and had nice eyes. A little vague, don't you think? Well, until next time, Anne Frank. P.S. This morning we all took turns on the scale. Margot now weighs 132 pounds, Mother 136, Father 155, Anne 96, Peter 149, Mrs. Van Dan 117, Mr. Van Dan 165. In the 3 months since I've been here, I've gained 19 pounds. A lot, huh? Tuesday, October 20th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, my hand's still shaking, though it's been 2 hours since we had the scare. I should explain that there are 5 fire extinguishers in the building. The office staff stupidly forgot to warn us that the carpenter, or whatever he's called, was coming to fill the extinguishers. As a result, we didn't bother to be quiet until I heard the sound of hammering on the landing across from the bookcase. I immediately assumed it was the carpenter and went to warn Bep, who was eating lunch, that she couldn't go back downstairs. Father and I stationed ourselves at the door so we could hear when the man had left. After working for about 15 minutes, he laid his hammer and some other tools on our bookcase, or so we thought, and banged on our door. We turned white with fear. Had he heard something after all and now wanted to check out this mysterious-looking bookcase? It seemed so, since he kept knocking, pulling, pushing, and jerking on it. I was so scared I nearly fainted at the thought of this total stranger managing to discover our wonderful hiding place. Just when I thought my days were numbered, we heard Mr. Clyman's voice saying, "Open up! It's me!" We opened the door at once. What had happened? The hook fastening the bookcase had gotten stuck, which is why no one had been able to warn us about the carpenter. After the man had left, Mr. Clyman came to get Bep, but couldn't open the bookcase. I can't tell you how relieved I was. In my imagination, the man I thought was trying to get inside the secret annex had kept growing and growing until he'd become not only a giant, but also the cruelest fascist in the world. Phew. Fortunately, everything worked out all right, at least this time. We had lots of fun on Monday. Miep and Jan spent the night with us. Margo and I slept in Father and Mother's room for the night so the guyses could have our beds. The menu was drawn up in their honor, and the meal was delicious. The festivities were briefly interrupted when Father's lamp caused a short circuit and we were suddenly plunged into darkness. What were we to do? We did have fuses, but the fuse box was at the rear of the dark warehouse, which made this particularly unpleasant job at night. Still, the men ventured forth, and 10 minutes later we were able to put away the candles. I was up early this morning. Jan was already dressed. Since he had to leave at 8:30, he was upstairs eating breakfast by 8. Miep was busy getting dressed, and I found her in her undershirt when I came in. She wears the same kind of long underwear I do when she bicycles. Margot and I threw on our clothes as well, and were upstairs earlier than usual. After a pleasant breakfast, Miep headed downstairs. It was pouring outside, and she was glad she didn't have to bicycle to work. Daddy and I made the beds, and afterward I learned 5 irregular French verbs. Quite industrious, don't you think? Margot and Peter were reading in our room, with Mushi curled up beside Margot on the divan. After my irregular French verbs, I joined them and read, "The woods are singing for all eternity." It's quite a beautiful book, but very unusual. I'm almost finished. Next week, it's Bep's turn to spend the night. Yours, Anne. Thursday, October 29th, 1942. My dearest Kitty, I'm very worried. Father's sick. He's covered with spots and has a high temperature. It looks like measles. Just think, we can't even call a doctor. Mother is making him perspire in hopes of sweating out the fever. This morning, Miep told us that the furniture has been removed from the Van Dan's apartment on Zeder Amstelen. We haven't told Mrs. Van D yet. She's been so nervous lately, and we don't feel like hearing her moan and groan again about all the beautiful china and lovely chairs she had to leave behind. We had to abandon most of our nice things, too. What's the good of grumbling about it now? Father wants me to start reading books by Hebbel and other well-known German writers. I can read German fairly well by now, except that I usually mumble the words instead of reading them silently to myself. But that'll pass. Father has taken the plays of Goethe and Schiller down from the big bookcase and is planning to read to me every evening. We've started off with Don Carlos. Encouraged by Father's good example, Mother pressed her prayer book into my hands. I read a few prayers in German, just to be polite. They certainly sound beautiful, but they mean very little to me. Why is she making me act so religious and devout? Tomorrow we're going to light the stove for the first time. The chimney hasn't been swept in ages, so the room is bound to fill with smoke. Let's hope the thing draws. Yours, Anne. Monday, November 2nd, 1942. Dear Kitty, Bep stayed with us Friday evening. It was fun, but she didn't sleep very well because she'd drunk some wine. For the rest, there's nothing special to report. I had an awful headache yesterday and went to bed early. Margot's being exasperating again. This morning I began sorting out an index card file from the office because it had fallen over and gotten all mixed up. Before long, I was going nuts. I asked Margot and Peter to help, but they were too lazy, so I put it away. I'm not crazy enough to do it all by myself. Anne Frank. P.S. I forgot to mention the important news that I'm probably going to get my period soon. I can tell because I keep finding a whitish smear in my panties, and Mother predicted it would start soon. I can hardly wait. It's such a momentous event. Too bad I can't use sanitary napkins. But you can't get them anymore, and Mama's tampons can be used only by women who've had a baby. Comment added by Anne on January 22, 1944. I wouldn't be able to write that kind of thing anymore. Now that I'm rereading my diary after a year and a half, I'm surprised at my childish innocence. Deep down, I know I could never be that innocent again, however much I'd like to be. I can understand the mood changes and comments about Margot, Mother, and Father as if I'd written them only yesterday, but I cannot imagine writing so openly about other matters. It embarrasses me greatly to read the pains dealing with subjects that I remembered as being nicer than they actually were. My descriptions are so indelicate. But enough of that. I can also understand my homesickness and yearning for Mortia. The whole time I've been here, I've longed unconsciously and at times consciously for trust, love, and physical affection. This longing may change in intensity, but it's always there. Thursday, November 5th, 1942. Dear Kitty, the British have finally scored a few successes in Africa, and Stalingrad hasn't fallen yet. So the men are happy, and we had coffee and tea this morning. For the rest, nothing special to report. This week I've been reading a lot and doing little work. That's the way things ought to be. That's surely the road to success. Mother and I are getting along better lately, but we're never close. Father's not very open about his feelings, but he's the same sweetheart he's always been. We lit the stove a few days ago, and the entire room is still filled with smoke. I prefer central heating, and I'm probably not the only one. Margo's a stinker. There's no other word for it. A constant source of irritation morning, noon, and night. Anne Frank. Saturday, November 7th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, Mother's nerves are very much on edge, and that doesn't bode well for me. Is it just a coincidence that Father and Mother never scold Margot and always blame me for everything? Last night, for example, Margot was reading a book with beautiful illustrations. She got up and put the book aside for later. I wasn't doing anything, so I picked it up and began looking at the pictures. Margot came back, saw her book in my hands, knitted her brow, and angrily demanded the book back. I wanted to look through it some more. Margot got madder by the minute, and Mother butted in. Margot was reading that book. Give it back to her. Father came in, and without even knowing what was going on, saw that Margot was being wronged and lashed out at me. I'd like to see what you'd do if Margot was looking at one of your books. I promptly gave in, put the book down, and according to them, left the room in a huff. I was neither huffy nor cross, but merely sad. It wasn't right of Father to pass judgment without knowing what the issue was. I would have given the book to Margot myself and a lot sooner if Father and Mother hadn't intervened and rushed to take Margot's part, as if she were suffering some great injustice. Of course Mother took Margot's side. They always take each other's sides. I'm so used to it that I've become completely indifferent to Mother's rebukes and Margot's moodiness. I love them, but only because they're Mother and Margot. I don't give a darn about them as people. As far as I'm concerned, they can go jump in a lake. It's different with Father. When I see him being partial to Margot, approving Margot's every action, praising her, hugging her, I feel a gnawing ache inside because I'm crazy about him. I model myself after Father, and there's no one in the world I love more. He doesn't realize that he treats Margot differently than he does me. Margot just happens to be the smartest, the kindest, the prettiest, and the best. But I have a right to be taken seriously, too. I've always been the clown and the mischief maker of the family. I've always had to pay double for my sins, once with scoldings and then again with my own sense of despair. I'm no longer satisfied with the meaningless affection or the supposedly serious talks. I long for something from Father that he's incapable of giving. I'm not jealous of Margot. I never have been. I'm not envious of her brains or her beauty. It's just that I'd like to feel that Father really loves me. Not because I'm his child, but because I'm me, Anne. I cling to Father because my contempt of Mother is growing daily, and it's only through him that I'm able to retain the last ounce of family feeling I have left. He doesn't understand that I sometimes need to vent my feelings for Mother. He doesn't want to talk about it, and he avoids any discussion involving Mother's failings. And yet Mother, with all her shortcomings, is tougher for me to deal with. I don't know how I should act. I can't very well confront her with her carelessness, her sarcasm, and her hard-heartedness, yet I can't continue to take the blame for everything. I'm the opposite of Mother, so of course we clash. I don't mean to judge her. I don't have that right. I'm simply looking at her as a mother. She's not a mother to me. I have to mother myself. I've cut myself adrift from them. I'm charting my own course, and we'll see where it leads me. I have no choice because I can picture what a mother and wife should be and can't seem to find anything of the sort in the woman I'm supposed to call Mother. I tell myself time and again to overlook Mother's bad example. I only want to see her good points and to look inside myself for what's lacking in her. But it doesn't work. And the worst part is that Father and Mother don't realize their own inadequacies and how much I blame them for letting me down. Are there any parents who can make their children completely happy? Sometimes I think God is trying to test me, both now and in the future. I'll have to become a good person on my own, without anyone to serve as a model or advise me. But it'll make me stronger in the end. Who else but me is ever going to read these letters? Who else but me can I turn to for comfort? I'm frequently in need of consolation. I often feel weak, and more often than not, I fail to meet expectations. I know this, and every day I resolve to do better. They aren't consistent in their treatment of me. One day they say that Anne's a sensible girl and entitled to know everything, and the next, that Anne's a silly goose who doesn't know a thing and yet imagines she's learned all she needs to know from books. I'm no longer the baby and spoiled little darling whose every deed can be laughed at. I have my own ideas, plans, and ideals, but I'm unable to articulate them yet. Oh well. So much comes into my head at night when I'm alone, or during the day when I'm obliged to put up with people I can't abide or who invariably misinterpret my intentions. That's why I always wind up coming back to my diary. I start there and end there because Kitty's always patient. I promise her that despite everything, I'll keep going, that I'll find my own way and choke back my tears. I only wish I could see some results, or just once, receive encouragement from someone who loves me. Don't condemn me, but think of me as a person who sometimes reaches the bursting point. Yours, Anne. Monday, November 9th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, yesterday was Peter's birthday, his 16th. I was upstairs by 8, and Peter and I looked at his presents. He received a game of Monopoly, a razor, and a cigarette lighter. Not that he smoked so much, not at all. It just looked so distinguished. The biggest surprise came from Mr. Van Dan, who reported at 1 that the English had landed in Tunis, Algiers, Casablanca, and Oran. This is the beginning of the end, everyone was saying. But Churchill, the British Prime Minister, who must have heard the same thing being repeated in England, declared, "This is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end. But it is, perhaps, the end of the beginning." Do you see the difference? However, there's reason for optimism. Stalingrad, the Russian city that has been under attack for 3 months, still hasn't fallen into German hands. In the true spirit of the annex, I should talk to you about food. I should explain that they're real gluttons up on the top floor. Bread is delivered daily by a very nice baker, a friend of Mr. Kleiman's. Of course, we don't have as much as we did at home, but it's enough. We also purchase ration books on the black market. The price keeps going up. It's already risen from 27 to 33 guilders, and that for mere sheets of printed paper. To provide ourselves with a source of nutrition that will keep, aside from the 100 cans of food we've stored here, we bought 300 pounds of beans. Not just for us, but for the office staff as well. We'd hung the sacks of beans on hooks in the hallway just inside our secret entrance, but a few seemed split under the weight. So we decided to move them to the attic, and Peter was entrusted with the heavy lifting. He managed to get 5 of the 6 sacks upstairs intact, and was busy with the last one when the sack broke and a flood, rather a hailstorm, of brown beans went flying through the air and down the stairs. Since there were about 50 pounds of beans in that sack, it made enough noise to raise the dead. Downstairs, they were sure the house was falling down around their heads. Peter was stunned, but then burst into peals of laughter when he saw me standing at the bottom of the stairs, like an island in a sea of brown, with waves of beans lapping at my ankles. We promptly began picking them up, but beans are so small and slippery that they roll into every conceivable corner and hole. Now, each time we go upstairs, we bend over and hunt around so we can present Mrs. Van Dan with a handful of beans. I almost forgot to mention that Father has recovered from his illness. Yours, Anne. P.S. The radio has just announced that Algiers has fallen. Morocco, Casablanca, and Oran have been in English hands for several days. We're now waiting for Tunis. Tuesday, November 10th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, great news! We're planning on taking an 8th person into hiding with us. Yes, really. We always thought there was enough room and food for one more person, but we were afraid of placing an even greater burden on Mr. Kugler and Mr. Kleiman. But since reports of the dreadful things being done to the Jews are getting worse by the day, Father decided to sound out these two gentlemen, and they thought it was an excellent plan. It's just as dangerous, whether there are 7 or 8, they noted rightly. Once this was settled, we sat down and mentally went through our circle of acquaintances, trying to come up with a single person who would blend in well with our extended family. This wasn't difficult. After Father had rejected all the Van Dan relatives, we chose a dentist named Alfred Dussel. He lives with a charming Christian lady who's quite a bit younger than he is. They're probably not married, but that's beside the point. He's known to be quiet and refined, and he seemed, from our superficial acquaintance with him, to be nice. Miep knows him as well, so she'll be able to make the necessary arrangements. If he comes, Mr. Dussel will have to sleep in my room instead of Margot, who will have to make do with the folding bed. After Dussel arrived, Margot slept in her parents' bedroom. We'll ask him to bring along something to fill cavities with. Yours, Anne. Tuesday, November 12, 1942. Miep came to tell us she'd been to see Dr. Dussel. He asked her the moment she entered the room if she knew of a hiding place and was enormously pleased when Miep said she had something in mind. She added that he'd need to go into hiding as soon as possible, preferably Saturday, but he thought this was highly improbable since he wanted to bring his records up to date, settle his accounts, and attend to a couple of patients. Miep relayed the message to us this morning. We didn't think it was wise to wait so long. All these preparations require explanations to various people who we feel ought to be kept in the dark. Miep went to ask if Dr. Dussel couldn't manage to come on Saturday after all, but he said no, and now he's scheduled to arrive on Monday. I think it's odd that he doesn't jump at our proposal. If they pick him up on the street, it won't help either his records or his patients, so why the delay? If you ask me, it's stupid of Father to humor him. Otherwise, no news. Yours, Anne. Tuesday, November 17th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, Mr. Dussel has arrived. Everything went smoothly. Miep told him to be at a certain place in front of the post office at 11 a.m. when a man would meet him, and he was at the appointed place at the appointed time. Mr. Kleiman went up to him, announced that the man he was expecting to meet was unable to come, and asked him to drop by the office to see Miep. Mr. Kleiman took a streetcar back to the office while Mr. Dussel followed on foot. It was 11:20 when Mr. Dussel tapped on the office door. Miep asked him to remove his coat so the yellow star couldn't be seen, and brought him to the private office where Mr. Kleiman kept him occupied until the cleaning lady had gone. On the pretext that the private office was needed for something else, Miep took Mr. Dussel upstairs, opened the bookcase, and stepped inside, while Mr. Dussel looked on in amazement. In the meantime, the seven of us had seated ourselves around the dining table to await the latest addition to our family with coffee and cognac. Miep first led him into the Frank family's room. He immediately recognized our furniture, but had no idea we were upstairs, just above his head. When Miep told him, he was so astonished he nearly fainted. Thank goodness she didn't leave him in suspense any longer, but brought him upstairs. Mr. Dussel sank into a chair and stared at us in dumbstruck silence, as though he thought he could read the truth on our faces. Then he stuttered, but you nicked in Belgium. The officer, the auto, they were not coming? Your escape was not working? We explained the whole thing to him, about how we deliberately spread the rumor of the officer and the car to throw the Germans and anyone else who might come looking for us off the track. Mr. Dussel was speechless in the face of such ingenuity, and could do nothing but gaze around in surprise as he explored the rest of our lovely and ultra-practical annex. We all had lunch together. Then he took a short nap, joined us for tea, put away a few belongings Miep had been able to bring here in advance, and began to feel much more at home, especially when we handed him the following typewritten rules and regulations for the secret annex. A Van Dan production. Prospectus and Guide to the Secret Annex. A unique facility for the temporary accommodation of Jews and other dispossessed persons. Open all year round. Located in beautiful, quiet, wooded surroundings in the heart of Amsterdam. No private residences in the vicinity. Can be reached by streetcar 13 or 17, and also by car and bicycle. For those to whom such transportation has been forbidden by the German authorities, it can also be reached on foot. Furnished and unfurnished rooms and apartments are available at all times, with or without meals. Price, free. Diet, low fat. Running water in the bathroom, sorry, no bath, and on various inside and outside walls. Cozy wood stoves for heating. Ample storage space for a variety of goods. Two large, modern safes. Private radio with a direct line to London, New York, Tel Aviv, and many other stations. Available to all residents after 6 p.m. No listening to forbidden broadcast, with certain exceptions, i.e. German stations may only be tuned in to listen to classical music. It is absolutely forbidden to listen to German news bulletins, regardless of where they are transmitted from, and to pass them on to others. Rest hours, from 10 p.m. to 7:30 a.m., 10:15 a.m. on Sundays. Owing to circumstances, residents are required to observe rest hours during the daytime when instructed to do so by management. To ensure the safety of all, rest hours must be strictly observed. Free time activities. None allowed outside the house until further notice. Use of language. It is necessary to speak softly at all times. Only the language of civilized people may be spoken. Thus, no German. Reading and relaxation. No German books may be read, except for the classics and works of a scholarly nature. Other books are optional. Calisthenics, daily. Singing, only softly, and after 6 p.m. Movies, prior arrangements required. Classes, a weekly correspondence course in shorthand. Courses in English, French, math, and history offered at any hour of the day or night. Payment in the form of tutoring, e.g. Dutch. Separate department for the care of small household pets, with the exception of vermin, for which special permits are required. Mealtimes. Breakfast at 9 a.m. daily, except holidays and Sundays, at approximately 11:30 a.m. on Sundays and holidays. Lunch. A light meal from 1:15 to 1:45 p.m. Dinner. May or not be a hot meal. Mealtime depends on news broadcasts. Obligations with respect to the Supply Corps. Residents must be prepared to help with office work at all times. Baths. The wash tub is available to all residents after 9 a.m. on Sundays. Residents may bathe in the bathroom, kitchen, private office, or front office as they choose. Alcohol. For medicinal purposes only. The end. Yours, Anne. Ana pripić kibre się dogadno, w komerki ciepło, uczyć trzeba nasz małych dzieciaczek, kome salewo, uczyć trzeba nasz małych dzieciaczek, kome salewo. Thursday, November 19th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, just as we thought, Mr. Dussel is a very nice man. Of course, he didn't mind having to share a room with me. To be honest, I'm not exactly delighted at having a stranger use my things, but you have to make sacrifices for a good cause, and I'm glad I can make this small one. If we can save even one of our friends, the rest doesn't matter, said Father, and he's absolutely right. The first day Mr. Dussel was here, he asked me all sorts of questions. For example, what time the cleaning lady comes to the office, how we've arranged to use the washroom, and when we're allowed to go to the toilet. You may laugh, but these things aren't so easy in a hiding place. During the daytime, we can't make any noise that might be heard downstairs, and when someone else is there, like the cleaning lady, we have to be extra careful. I patiently explained all this to Mr. Dussel, but I was surprised to see how slow he is to catch on. He asks everything twice and still can't remember what you've told him. Maybe he's just confused by the sudden change and he'll get over it. Otherwise, everything is going fine. Mr. Dussel has told us much about the outside world we've missed for so long. He had sad news. Countless friends and acquaintances have been taken off to a dreadful fate. Night after night, green and gray military vehicles cruise the streets. They knock on every door asking whether any Jews live there. If so, the whole family is immediately taken away. If not, they proceed to the next house. It's impossible to escape their clutches unless you go into hiding. They often go around with lists, knocking only on those doors where they know there's a big haul to be made. They frequently offer a bounty, so much per head. It's like the slave hunts of the olden days. I don't mean to make light of this. It's much too tragic for that. In the evenings when it's dark, I often see long lines of good, innocent people accompanied by crying children walking on and on, ordered about by a handful of men who bully and beat them until they nearly drop. No one is spared. The sick, the elderly, children, babies, and pregnant women all are marched to their death. We're so fortunate here, away from the turmoil. We wouldn't have to give a moment's thought to all this suffering if it weren't for the fact that we're so worried about those we hold dear, whom we can no longer help. I feel wicked sleeping in a warm bed while somewhere out there my dearest friends are dropping from exhaustion or being knocked to the ground. I get frightened myself when I think of close friends who are now at the mercy of the cruelest monsters ever to stalk the earth. And all because they're Jews. Yours, Anne. Friday, November 20th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, we don't really know how to react. Up to now, very little news about the Jews had reached us here, and we thought it best to stay as cheerful as possible. Every now and then, Meep used to mention what had happened to a friend, and Mother or Mrs. Van Dan would start to cry, so she decided it was better not to say any more. But we bombarded Mr. Dussel with questions, and the stories he had to tell were so gruesome and dreadful that we can't get them out of our heads. Once we've had time to digest the news, we'll probably go back to our usual joking and teasing. It won't do us or those outside any good if we continue to be as gloomy as we are now. And what would be the point of turning the secret annex into a melancholy annex? No matter what I'm doing, I can't help thinking about those who are gone. I catch myself laughing and remember that it's a disgrace to be so cheerful. But am I supposed to spend the whole day crying? No, I can't do that. This gloom will pass. Added to this misery, there's another, but of a more personal nature, and it pales in comparison to the suffering I've just told you about. Still, I can't help telling you that lately I've begun to feel deserted. I'm surrounded by too great a void. I never used to give it much thought, since my mind was filled with my friends and having a good time. Now I think either about unhappy things or about myself. It's taken a while, but I've finally realized that Father, no matter how kind he may be, can't take the place of my former world. When it comes to my feelings, Mother and Margot ceased to count long ago. But why do I bother you with this foolishness? I'm terribly ungrateful, Kitty, I know. But when I've been scolded for the umpteenth time and have all these other woes to think about as well, my head begins to reel. Yours, Anne.
Love is
Saturday, November 21st, 1942. Dearest Kitty, we've been using too much electricity and have now exceeded our ration. The result? Excessive economy and the prospect of having the electricity cut off. No light for 14 days. That's a pleasant thought, isn't it? But who knows, maybe it won't be so long. It's too dark to read after 4 or 4:30, so we while away the time with all kinds of crazy activities. Telling riddles, doing calisthenics in the dark, speaking English or French, reviewing books. After a while, everything gets boring. Yesterday, I discovered a new pastime, using a good pair of binoculars to peek into the lighted rooms of the neighbors. During the day, our curtains can't be opened, not even an inch, but there's no harm when it's so dark. I never knew that neighbors could be so interesting. Ours are, at any rate. I've come across a few at dinner, one family making home movies, and the dentist across the way working on a frightened old lady. Mr. Dussel, the man who was said to get along so well with children and to absolutely adore them, has turned out to be an old-fashioned disciplinarian and preacher of unbearably long sermons on manners. Since I have the singular pleasure of sharing my far too narrow room with His Excellency, and since I'm generally considered to be the worst behaved of the three young people, it's all I can do to avoid having the same old scoldings and admonitions repeatedly flung at my head and to pretend not to hear. This wouldn't be so bad if Mr. Dussel weren't such a tattletale and hadn't singled out Mother to be the recipient of his reports. If Mr. Dussel's just read me the Riot Act, Mother lectures me all over again, this time throwing the whole book at me. And if I'm really lucky, Mrs. Van D calls me to account 5 minutes later and lays down the law as well. Really, It's not easy being the badly brought up center of attention of a family of nitpickers. In bed at night, as I ponder my many sins and exaggerated shortcomings, I get so confused by the sheer amount of things I have to consider that I either laugh or cry, depending on my mood. Then I fall asleep with the strange feeling of wanting to be different than I am, or being different than I want to be, or perhaps of behaving differently than I am or want to be. Oh dear, now I'm confusing you too. Forgive me, but I don't like crossing things out, and in these times of scarcity, tossing away a piece of paper is clearly taboo. So I can only advise you not to reread the above passage and to make no attempt to get to the bottom of it, because you'll never find your way out again. Yours, Anne. Monday, December 7th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, Hanukkah and St. Nicholas Day nearly coincided this year. They were only one day apart. We didn't make much of a fuss with Hanukkah, merely exchanging a few small gifts and lighting the candles. Since candles are in short supply, we lit them for only 10 minutes. But as long as we sing the song, that doesn't matter. Mr. Van Dan made a menorah out of wood, so that was taken care of, too. St. Nicholas Day on Saturday was much more fun. During dinner, Bep and Miep were so busy whispering to Father that our curiosity was aroused and we suspected they were up to something. Sure enough, at 8 o'clock we all trooped downstairs through the hall in pitch darkness. It gave me the shivers and I wished I was safely back upstairs to the alcove. We could switch on the light, since this room doesn't have any windows. When that was done, Father opened the big cabinet. Oh, how wonderful! We all cried. In the corner was a large basket decorated with colorful paper and a mask of Black Peter. We quickly took the basket upstairs with us. Inside was a little gift for everyone, including an appropriate verse. Since you're familiar with the kinds of poems people write each other on St. Nicholas Day, I won't copy them down for you. I received a Cupid doll, Father got bookends, and so on. Well, anyway, it was a nice idea, and since the eight of us had never celebrated St. Nicholas Day before, this was a good time to begin. Yours, Anne. P.S. We also had presents for everyone downstairs, a few things left over from the good old days. Plus, Miep and Bep are always grateful for money. Today we heard that Mr. Van Dan's ashtray, Mr. Dussel's picture frame, and Father's bookends were made by none other than Mr. Voskuhl. How anyone can be so clever with his hands is a mystery to me. Thursday, December 10th. 1942. Dearest Kitty, Mr. Van Dan used to be in the meat, sausage, and spice business. He was hired for his knowledge of spices, and yet, to our great delight, it's his sausage talents that have come in handy now. We ordered a large amount of meat, under the counter, of course, that we were planning to preserve in case there were hard times ahead. Mr. Van Dan decided to make bratwurst, sausages, and metwurst. I had fun watching him put the meat through the grinder once, twice, three times. Then he added the remaining ingredients to the ground meat and used a long pipe to force the mixture into the casings. We ate the bratwurst with sauerkraut for lunch, but the sausages, which were going to be canned, had to be dried first, so we hung them over a pole suspended from the ceiling. Everyone who came into the room burst into laughter when they saw the dangling sausages. It was such a comical sight. The kitchen was a shambles. Mr. Van Dan, clad in his wife's apron and looking fatter than ever, was working away at the meat. What with his bloody hands, red face, and spotted apron, he looked like a real butcher. Mrs. Van D was trying to do everything at once, learning Dutch out of a book, stirring the soup, watching the meat, sighing and moaning about her broken rib. That's what happens when old ladies do such stupid exercises to get rid of their fat behinds. Dussel had an eye infection and was sitting next to the stove, dabbing his eye with chamomile tea. Pim, seated in the one ray of sunshine coming through the window, kept having to move his chair this way and that to stay out of the way. His rheumatism must have been bothering him because he was slightly hunched over and was keeping an eye on Mr. Van Dan with an agonized expression on his face. He reminded me of those aged invalids you see in the poorhouse. Peter was romping around the room with Mushi, the cat, while Mother, Margot, and I were peeling boiled potatoes. When you get right down to it, none of us were doing our work properly because we were all so busy watching Mr. Van Dan. Dussel has opened his dental practice. Just for fun, I'll describe the session with his very first patient. Mother was ironing, and Mrs. Van D, the first victim, sat down on a chair in the middle of the room. Dussel, unpacking his case with an air of importance, asked for some eau de cologne, which could be used as a disinfectant, and Vaseline, which would have to do for wax. He looked in Mrs. Van D's mouth and found two teeth that made her wince with pain and utter incoherent cries every time he touched them. After a lengthy examination, lengthy as far as Mrs. Van D was concerned, since it actually took no longer than 2 minutes, Dussel began to scrape out a cavity. But Mrs. Van D had no intention of letting him. She flailed her arms and legs until Dussel finally let go of his probe, and it remained stuck in Mrs. Van D's tooth. That really did it. Mrs. Van D lashed out wildly in all directions, cried as much as you can with an instrument like that in your mouth, tried to remove it, but only managed to push it in even further. Mr. Dussel calmly observed the scene, his hands on his hips, while the rest of the audience roared with laughter. Of course, that was very mean of us. If it had been me, I'm sure I would have yelled even louder. After a great deal of squirming, kicking, screaming, and shouting, Mrs. Van D finally managed to yank the thing out. And Mr. Dussel went on with his work as if nothing had happened. He was so quick that Mrs. Van D didn't have time to pull any more shenanigans. But then he had more help than he's ever had before, no fewer than two assistants. Mr. Van D and I performed our job well. The whole scene resembled one of those engravings from the Middle Ages entitled A Quack at Work. In the meantime, however, the patient was getting restless since she had to keep an eye on her soup and her food. One thing is certain, it'll be a while before Mrs. Van D makes another dental appointment. Yours, Anne. Sunday, December 13th, 1942. Dearest Kitty, I'm sitting here nice and cozy in the front office, peering out through a chink in the heavy curtains. It's dusky, but there's just enough light to write by. It's really strange watching people walk past. They all seem to be in such a hurry that they nearly trip over their own feet. Those on bicycles whiz by so fast I can't tell who's on the bike. The people in this neighborhood aren't particularly attractive to look at. The children especially are so dirty, you wouldn't want to touch them with a 10-foot pole. Real slum kids with runny noses. I can hardly understand a word they say. Yesterday afternoon, when Margot and I were taking a bath, I said, "What if we took a fishing rod and reeled in each of those kids one by one as they walked by, stuck them in the tub, washed and mended their clothes, and then tomorrow they'd be just as dirty and tattered as they were before," Margot replied. But I'm babbling. There are also other things to look at. Cars, boats, and the rain. I can hear the streetcar and the children, and I'm enjoying myself. Our thoughts are subject to as little change as we are. They're like a merry-go-round, turning from the Jews to food, from food to politics. By the way, speaking of Jews, I saw two yesterday when I was peeking through the curtains. I felt as though I was gazing at one of the seven wonders of the world. It gave me such a funny feeling, as if I'd denounced them to the authorities and was now spying on their misfortune. Across from us is a houseboat. The captain lives there with his wife and children. He has a small yapping dog. We know the little dog only by its bark and by its tail, which we can see whenever it runs around the deck. Oh, what a shame. It's just started raining and most of the people are hidden under their umbrellas. All I can see are raincoats and now and again the back of a stocking-capped head. Actually, I don't even need to look. By now, I can recognize the women at a glance. Gone to fat from eating potatoes, dressed in a red or green coat and worn-out shoes, a shopping bag dangling from their arms, with faces that are either grim or good-humored, depending on the mood of their husbands. Yours, Anne.
Love is
Tuesday, December 22nd, 1942. Dearest Kitty, the annex was delighted to hear that we'll all be receiving an extra quarter pound of butter for Christmas. According to the newspaper, everyone is entitled to half a pound, but they mean those lucky souls who get their ration books from the government, not Jews in hiding like us who can only afford to buy 4 rather than 8 ration books on the black market. Each of us is going to bake something with the butter. This morning I made 2 cakes and a batch of cookies. It's very busy upstairs, and Mother has informed me that I'm not to do any studying or reading until all the household chores have been finished. Mrs. Van Dan is lying in bed nursing her bruised rib. She complains all day long, constantly demands that the bandages be changed, and is generally dissatisfied with everything. I'll be glad when she gets back on her feet and can clean up after herself, because I must admit, she's extraordinarily hardworking and neat, and as long as she's in good physical and mental condition, she's quite cheerful. As if I don't hear shh, shh enough during the day because I'm always making too much noise, my dear roommate has come up with the idea of saying shh, shh to me all night, too. According to him, I shouldn't even turn over. I refuse to take any notice of him, and the next time he shushes me, I'm going to shush him right back. He gets more exasperating and egotistical as the days go by. Except for the first week, I haven't seen even one of the cookies he so generously promised me. He's particularly infuriating on Sundays when he switches on the light at the crack of dawn to exercise for 10 minutes. To me, the torment seems to last for hours, since the chairs I use to make my bed longer are constantly being jiggled under my sleepy head. After rounding off his limbering up exercises with a few vigorous arm swings, his lordship begins dressing. His underwear is hanging on a hook, so first he lumbers over to get it and then lumbers back past my bed. But his tie is on the table, so once again he pushes and bumps his way past the chairs. But I mustn't waste any more of your time griping about disgusting old men. It won't help matters anyway. My plans for revenge, such as unscrewing the light bulb, locking the door, and hiding his clothes, have unfortunately had to be abandoned in the interests of peace. Oh, I'm becoming so sensible. We've got to be reasonable about everything we do here. Studying, listening, holding our tongues, helping others, being kind, making compromises, and I don't know what else. I'm afraid my common sense, which was in short supply to begin with, will be used up too quickly, and I won't have any left by the time the war is over. Yours, Anne. Wednesday, January 13th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, this morning I was constantly interrupted, and as a result, I haven't been able to finish a single thing I've begun. We have a new pastime, namely filling packages with powdered gravy. The gravy is one of Guy's and Company's products. Mr. Kugler hasn't been able to find anyone else to fill the packages, and besides, it's cheaper if we do the job. It's the kind of work they do in prisons. It's incredibly boring and makes us dizzy and giggly. Terrible things are happening outside. At any time of night and day, poor helpless people are being dragged out of their homes. They're allowed to take only a knapsack and a little cash with them, and even then, they're robbed of these possessions on the way. Families are torn apart. Men, women, and children are separated. Children come home from school to find that their parents have disappeared. Women return from shopping to find their houses sealed, their families gone. The Christians in Holland are also living in fear because their sons are being sent to Germany. Everyone is scared.
Every night, hundreds of planes pass over Holland on their way to German cities to sow their bombs on German soil. Every hour, hundreds, or maybe even thousands, of people are being killed in Russia and Africa. No one can keep out of the conflict. The entire world is at war. And even though the Allies are doing better, the end is nowhere in sight. As for us, we're quite fortunate, luckier than millions of people. It's quiet and safe here, and we're using our money to buy food. We're so selfish that we talk about after the war and look forward to new clothes and shoes, when actually we should be saving every penny to help others when the war is over, to salvage whatever we can. The children in this neighborhood run around in thin shirts and wooden shoes. They have no coats, no caps, no stockings, and no one to help them. Gnawing on a carrot to still their hunger pangs, they walk from their cold houses through cold streets to even colder classrooms. Things have gotten so bad in Holland that hordes of children stop passersby in the streets to beg for a piece of bread. I could spend hours telling you about the suffering the war has brought, but I'd only make myself more miserable. All we can do is wait, as calmly as possible, for it to end. Jews and Christians alike are waiting. The whole world is waiting. And many are waiting for death. Yours, Anne. Saturday, January 30th, 1943. Dearest Kitty, I'm seething with rage, yet I can't show it. I'd like to scream, stamp my foot, give Mother a good shaking cry, and I don't know what else because of the nasty words, mocking looks, and accusations that she hurls at me day after day, piercing me like arrows from a tightly strung bow, which are nearly impossible to pull from my body. I'd like to scream at Mother, Margot, the Van Dans, Dussel, and Father, too. Leave me alone. Let me have at least one night when I don't cry myself to sleep with my eyes blurring and my head pounding. Let me get away, away from everything, away from this world. But I can't do that. I can't let them see my doubts or the wounds they've inflicted on me. I couldn't bear their sympathy or their good-humored derision. It would only make me want to scream even more. Everyone thinks I'm showing off when I talk, ridiculous when I'm silent, insolent when I answer, cunning when I have a good idea, lazy when I'm tired, selfish when I eat one bite more than I should, stupid, cowardly, calculating, etc., etc. All day long I hear nothing but what an exasperating child I am, and although I laugh it off and pretend not to mind, I do mind. I wish I could ask God to give me another personality, one that doesn't antagonize everyone. But that's impossible. I'm stuck with the character I was born with. And yet I'm sure I'm not a bad person. I do my best to please everyone more than they'd ever suspect in a million years. When I'm upstairs, I try to laugh it off because I don't want them to see my troubles. More than once, after a series of absurd reproaches, I've snapped at Mother. I don't care what you say. Why don't you just wash your hands of me? I'm a hopeless case. Of course, she'd tell me not to talk back and virtually ignore me for 2 days. Then suddenly, all would be forgotten and she'd treat me like everyone else. It's impossible for me to be all smiles one day and venomous the next. I'd rather choose the golden mean, which isn't so golden, and keep my thoughts to myself. Perhaps sometime I'll treat the others with the same contempt as they treat me. Oh, if only I could. Yours, Anne.
That's all the time we have for today's reading from Anne Frank, The Diary of a Young Girl. Join us at the same time next week. Thanks again for listening. If you know someone who could benefit from our service, point them our direction. If you know someone who would like to contribute in any way, point them in our direction. You can call us at 919-832-5138 or visit our website at triangleReadingService.org. Once again, I'm Randy Wasserstrom. From Susie, from me, and everyone here at TRRS, have a nice rest of the day.
you.